you start at the business model. Why is the business model working? Why is the market working? And then you look at the cash flows and the timing of cash flows and the assets that are, you know, circulating. And those are the points on which you can develop a financing structure.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models. Welcome to the fifth episode of PaaS Decoded, 16 conversations about the fine details of product as a service. In the last episode, Boris Romero and Vincent van Lamoyen shared their learnings about refurbishment at Philips. In today's episode, we look at product as a service from the perspective of a bank. He has a background in political science, started his career at ING in Amsterdam, where he built up the portfolio and relationship management program. Afterwards, he joined General Electric Capital as executive director leveraged finance. For over 4 years, he is with Commerzbank, currently as co-lead of the ESG and Sustainable Finance Solutions team. Welcome, Leonard.
Hi, good morning. Welcome, Patrick. How are you?
I'm fine. Leonard, let's start with a private question. In private life, what's your most preferred financial instrument you use?
You know what? It's probably my banking app. It's where everything comes together, and on my phone, I'm in control of everything, of, you know, shares that I invest in and payment traffic. So it's all on my phone. I like that.
Okay, cool. All the good news on your phone.
It depends, right?
Yeah.
But at least I'm in control.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Let's talk about financial instruments for product as a services and companies. You're with Commerzbank as a bank, and you're regularly approached by companies of different size, and also from time to time, of course, when it comes to sustainability projects and product as a service. At what stage of company development does it make sense to reach out to you, to a bank, to provide financing?
So in general, as a bank, we are responsible for the money of our customers. So we have to be very careful with this money. And to borrow money from us directly, you need a certain level of maturity, as opposed to earlier stage companies that are more equity or mezzanine risk. In our view, a company becomes bankable or financeable once you have an existing and proven market. Your business model is up and running. So your customers and suppliers are there, and the company is successfully producing stuff or services. And this also means you have a cash flow. So at least, you know, you can still do expansion investments or ramp-up costs, but there needs to be an underlying positive cash flow. Because as a bank, we love growth, but it needs to be profitable, and you have to repay the debt in time. Then other things we will look at is your management quality or investor quality. You need some track record on that. You need a decent financial reporting, and you need a decent financial management. So I'm part of the corporate client segment, where we typically service very large customers from 100 million of sales up to several billions of sales. But overall, Commerzbank provides many different services also to smaller firms and to private clients. And it's not just financing, but to get financing with us, you have to be a more established client. We have a separate venture capital subsidiary. It's called Neosphere. And they actually invest equity in young companies, many of them around ESG topics like recycling and circularity. Right. Neosphere actually also organizes the largest B2B festival for sustainable innovation for ESG in Europe. It's called the Impact Festival. So there's a lot of interesting connections there also for us as a bank, and we learn from it. And it's not just about the financing. We need to bring together the people and the ideas for the transformation. And we are part of an ecosystem in that sense, also on behalf of our business customer. So the idea is that we connect the large corporates that we are financing with innovative startups, with investors, with ESG experts like yourselves, and with meta actors like NGOs. And we may not be financing everyone directly, but we certainly support the business development in several ways. And we have a cooperation with the Techriteer, the Bundesinitiative, Impact Investing, ESG investors like Agri right. Technology Funds, engineer firms for ESG technology, consultants, because it's only together that we can make the transformation work. But our part of the system, our role is to support the SMEs and the corporates, and other parts of the system are financed by venture capital, business angels, private equity, family offices. So there's different pockets of monies for different kinds of companies.
Okay. So if I get it right, let's separate it in three stages. So it would even make sense at the first stage if I have an idea, I'm already refining it, I want to get, let's say, some market feedback, it would make sense to reach out if financial aspects are a key component, and reaching out would be more like, let's say, a bit on sparing an ecosystem, knowing that this is not your core business. And at the second stage, you have the fund for early stage startups. And once you have established a running business with more or less predictable revenue streams, it doesn't have to be profitable yet, I guess, but it has to be clear that it becomes profitable also based on your financial support. Then in this third stage, it's in, let's say, in your core area of responsibility.
So to get the financing, bank financing means you have to be more mature. But even as a fresh startup, you need a bank account and payment traffic, right? For many companies, that's where it starts. So it's always useful to have a discussion with your bank, I think. And then it moves. Once you start developing your business model, you know, venture capital is your first go-to address or business angels. And then as you get more mature, you will get in contact with professional investors, long-term investors, and then also with banks, and then increasingly can also use bank financing. It depends on the business model and what you do exactly. But I think in general, to get bank financing, you know, you're more progressed in your business model. You have an existing cash flow. You have an upper running set of customers and suppliers and money going through your bank accounts. That's where it starts when you start the conversation with the bank on the financing.
Okay, cool. So let's dive a bit more deeper on that one, the bank financing with product as a service in mind. What data and information should I provide to you, and how should I have validated some assumptions when I reach out to you in order to discuss possible bank financing solutions?
So it very strongly depends on the type and size of financing. If you're looking at 500,000 working capital, you know, the questions are very different than if you're looking for 300 million financing to upgrade a large factory. But the organization of the customer is also very, very different. And Neosphere is expecting a different kind of reporting from a startup than our small enterprises desk will ask from a company that's been around for 5 years. And in some cases, we actually look at the value of the assets in the business as well to enable more larger financing. So you may be looking at inventory or commodities on the balance sheet that you can finance, or you may lease certain assets. Sometimes there's a guarantee from a parent company or from the local state. And if you have these elements in your financing, you need specific information and reporting on this, of course. But in most cases, we will look on the cash flow of the business, which is very easy if you have an existing business with 10 years track record. You go like, well, that's what happened in 10 years and I have an equity cushion. Yeah. But if you're a growing company and the company's scaling up and internationalizing, it becomes a lot more detailed, and you need to prove out what you're saying, and you need to show, you know, forward looking, where are you heading with your business? What are your expectations and plans in the next 5 years? Is this congruent with the market that you're in? How profitable are you? Are you actually generating cash, and can you repay the debt? How certain is this, and what does it depend on? What happens in a scenario where the legislation changes, or if a recession hit the market? What happens to your business? And then the other side of the equation is, how much are you spending in your business plan? And are you able to dial back the capital expenditure or the run-up cost if the growth and the cash flow maybe take a bit longer than you thought? So it's very case-specific, but I think a bank will always look for data and facts to support your assumptions. And it's our job to question this and analyze if the story is rounded and true. So numbers, data, facts have to support all of the story and ideas that you have. Because again, we have to take good care of customer money. That's our job.
Let's look again on the growth aspect or the future aspect. Of course, ideally, we think we can validate the future with data from the past. But of course, markets change. It might have been easy to reach first adopters. And then if you want to grow towards a larger market, you have different type of customers. So it's not necessarily scalable what you did in the past. Can you give some more insight? What kind of validation about the future and the growth plan can be provided by companies?
That's a very difficult question to answer in general mm-hmm. or generic, because it's very company specific. But what we will always look for is validation on, you know, is the technology working? Is it proven? Mm-hmm. Is the market there? Is it proven? Is it something that is likely to continue? And then you work your way back in your analysis from the market and then the regulation, the regulatory framework that you operate in. And then you go back in more detail in the business. How dependent are you maybe on certain customers, or suppliers, for instance? And then how profitable are you? How much control do you have over your profit margins? And that works back. And then what's your cost base? How fixed or flexible is your cost base? And we work through all of these aspects, which already shows that, you know, bank financing is, we try and be very precise and very concrete yeah. about what we finance. And so there's some work in it. And that also shows you the companies need to be a bit bigger to put in this much work.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you probably come across some challenges. What are the biggest challenges that determine the financing, and how can these challenges be solved?
So, let's get specific on circulars or products as a service business models. And yeah. and I think the first thing where we start is the reason to exist. So who will pay me for what I'm doing and why? And as a private company, it's not enough to want to help save the planet, where I like these kind of business models, but you also need to be profitable and make cash. And in particular, you need to have the producer and the end customer on board. So somebody to make the service and somebody to buy the services. In some cases, you actually need to consider all of the further parts of the value chain, like the logistics. So if you develop a new textile, somebody needs to weave it, cut it, make garments out of it before it ends in the yeah. shop. And even if I convince a large chain of stores and their customers, it wouldn't suffice to get my product running. I actually have to orchestrate all of the value chain in between. So that's the first thing. Who makes it? Who buys it? And then you need mm-hmm. to think about the cash flows in the system. Who's paying who when? Because it's liquidity that kills companies, not profitability. I've seen some very successful startups that run into major issues because their large corporate customer had a 3 month payment term, and they actually have to pay their own suppliers before they get paid by their customer. And you can solve for this, but you need to think about it up front. So you can do like reverse factoring on this and free up liquidity, but you need to have prepared for it. And then the third point, I think for products as a services, in very many cases, you need some kind of financing. Because what you're typically doing is you're creating an asset pool that you are providing to somebody else, and that you need to think about these things up front. And I think we look in the financial sector a bit differently on these things as many startups or Mittelständler do. But so it's always a question is where, who pays who when specifically, and yeah. how do I bridge time gaps in sort of the flow of cash on that?
Could you elaborate a bit more on the aspect of who will pay me for this and why? I can imagine with your, let's say, financial perspective, you have a special twist to that question.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for your question, Patrick. That's absolutely a great question. We actually had this challenge with payment methods as a bank. Because around mm-hmm. 2004, I was working in business development for internet and phone payments on behalf of merchants at point of sale and in the store and online. And there were so many solutions and ideas. I must have looked at over 100 payment methods, a lot of them startups, and most of them focused on consumers, mobilizing them to providing them a card or an e-wallet, etc. And then a few focused on the merchant side, so what we call acquiring, where the payment is accepted. And they had to offer low cost and fast processing of high volume, so already a bit contradictory. And then you have a platform issue, because in a nutshell, the merchant wants to not too many different methods, and he wants to have offer the payment methods that consumers will actually use and that are not expensive. And the consumers, on the other hand, they only want payment methods that the merchants accept, you know, and many different merchants accept. They don't want a different card for each shop. They don't want to pay anything for making their payments. And they like to get benefits like points or convenience or a nice looking card as a status symbol. And that actually costs money. So getting both sides right, it's very difficult. It requires a lot of patience and investment. And what is left, you know, of all those different payment methods? I think in the Netherlands, you have Ideal, then you have PayPal. But there's not so many left, and some of them who are left actually are not a full payment method, but they cooperate with MasterCard or Visa to solve the acceptance issues, and then you have payment processors. So there's some very interesting parallels, I think, with products as a services and circular value chains, because money is also always, it's a circulation, it's a loop, it's a platform, and you always need both sides of the equation. To start with the obvious parallel, so if I want to lease out my product, I need to have enough customers who want to rent it. And the customers, they want fair choice. They want a lot of choice at fair prices. So what you see that historically we had Mietkauf, so lease constructions in Germany. Uh-huh. This has always been around, but it was mostly for poor people who couldn't afford a new television or washing machine in another way. Uh-huh. And it was actually often a bit shady business, financing at high margins and then repossessing goods. And it has never become a mass phenomena. And then you also have pay-per-use like washing centers that I used as a student. But where products as a service or leasing in end effect has really worked is in some business-to-business environments. So leasing buildings, leasing cars, it has become the norm and to free up capital. And some of the buildings are even purpose-built or in single use, like rehab clinics. There's no real alternative use. And it's nothing else but buying a project and paying a monthly subscription for it instead of actually paying in cash. And lately, what we've seen is private leases on e-cars, which that's taking off. And why is it taking off? Because it's de-risking the consumer for the residual value of the e-car at a comparatively moderate rate. And why is this happening? Because for the producers, for the OEMs, it's the only way they get the cars in circulation because people are reluctant to buy and take the risk of owning the car. Yeah. But it shows that the model works fundamentally if the risk and reward and cost make sense. And I think this is partly still an issue. For instance, if you look at leasing heat pumps or solar cells, which are also products as a service models, which are already successful. But also there, I think the better the risk reward and cost becomes to the user, I think there's a lot more potential there. An interesting example that we saw was leasing out lights rather than buying armatures for offices. Mm-hmm. So this is something that makes a lot of sense from an environmental point of view, but it hasn't grown that strongly and it's not that easy because the question is what's the benefit for the customer? Given that it's a relatively small investment within, you know, setting up a whole building, and it's quite a long life with the lighting. So does the cost of coordination on this maybe outweigh the actual benefits for the user? But there are some great examples that do work. Like there's a German manufacturer of forklifts that I worked with in the past, and they discovered that the Chinese were undercutting the prices of their forklifts. They were half as expensive. But they discovered that their product life was at least three times that of the Chinese competitors because all the components, everything was higher value, was better built. And it actually ended up that they lease out more of their trucks instead of selling them because with the leasing rate, if I have three times product life, I can actually undercut my Chinese competitors and offer a better product at a reasonable price. And that's only, you know, vendor leasing is one form. But if you know the green crates for the supermarkets, you know, and the, where the fruits and the vegetables are in. This is a great example of products as a service, because it's a, it's multi-use circular crates that are leased for usage fee backed by deposit. And these have completely substituted the wood and cardboard boxes that I remember from when I was a kid. Sure. Fruits and vegetables were all in wood and cardboard. And I think in Germany, the Netherlands, other European countries, you don't even see them anymore. And this company covers the value chain from South America to Africa, Europe, and back, and has grown tremendously. So that's a great example for me how a products as a service business model works. And we see actually quite a lot in kind of the circular packaging solutions. Also, you know, shipping glass jars from glass factories to marmalade factories with reusable packaging. We're seeing some startups like providing Amazon with pouches instead of cardboard boxes. And I think financing these kind of asset pools, it's one of the key challenges for the financial sector on ESG, something how we can contribute to sort of closing the loop and being more careful about resources.
So would it be fair to say, if we look at the question you raised, who will pay me for this and why, would it be fair to say that you look at this question on three different layers? The first one is you mentioned the reward risk relationship. So what's the value proposition? What's the benefit for the customer? The second one is the cash flow design. Can I make sure that I get money at the right point in time to make sure that I cover my expenses? And the third layer is the payment methods that support, let's say, the previous two layers.
I'd say you start at the business model. Why is the business model working? Why is the market working? And then you look at the cash flows and the timing of cash flows and the assets that are, you know, circulating. And those are the points on which you can develop a financing structure. It's always a combination between sustainability, strategy, and financing. It's always those three. How do they connect, and how do I make a working structure out of it?
I have one more question in mind, but I want to park it, and this is about cash flow design, because you mentioned before the asset pools and the challenge to finance these asset pools. And I imagine asset pool financing and cash flow is a bit related. So let's maybe first look a bit at the key challenges you see when it comes to financing these asset pools. And then, let's look at that question again from the cash flow perspective. Where are the key challenges? Especially product as a service is a lot about asset pools. In many cases, they're with the provider and not with the customer anymore. So what are the challenges here?
I think the example we had with the green crates, and these are not even owned by any producer. It's a separate provider of a service that puts the crates in circulation, cleans them, and does the logistics. But I think the model, it's easy to understand. And fundamentally, this works also outside of logistics and packaging. So a vendor providing its products as a lease instead of selling it, like the forklift trucks, that's the base case. But I think a lot of things, we have a common pool of assets that different players can use. So maybe even a factory could be pool owned that produces different kind of plastic products and gets a better utilization in a way. And in a way, this is actually a very old model, because it goes back to the 19th century when contractors owned large agricultural vehicles and rented them out to farmers on a daily basis. And this is still in operation today, this model, because it just makes sense as a farm not to own a vehicle that I'm only using a week a year. And the same happens for cranes in construction. So these tend to be owned by leasing companies rather than individual building companies, because it makes share it makes sense to share these assets. You also see it at bottleries that mix and fill drinks for Coca-Cola as well as Pepsi as private label. These are all existing examples. And when I follow this up, if I have a steady state recycling, I could theoretically even finance the raw materials, so the copper in the electromotor, and only lease them out for the usage of X years. And the idea was actually proposed and executed for batteries in electric vehicles. So Renault tried it, the French auto manufacturer, I'm not sure why it hasn't worked. I think part of the issue may have been that it was only one car producer. So again, it wasn't the choice and I would get tied in with one producer. It might have been different if several large manufacturers would cooperate and there's an independent provider, you know, competing for the service of leasing the battery packs at fair prices. But it makes a lot of sense from environmental point of view, and it's nearer to the model that we know where the fuel is a separate cost item from owning the car. What I heard, there's also been some technical issues, so I'm not sure where it is. But I think the line of thought, where does the asset pool, and this can be the vendor, but also as a vendor, if I lease out my assets, I create an asset pool on the balance sheet. And so how do I finance this? How much is the metal holding dust worth, which comes as waste out of a blast furnace, but I can actually still extract metal from? How much is the used cotton worth that I can recycle, make new clothes from again? And in some cases, like mentioned before, we can finance the flow of goods and inventories, for instance, metal scrap, or the asset pool of the products that we circulate, such as, you know, the boring base for the crates that I mentioned before, where I have a fleet of assets. But it's very much, it's always a question of maturity. So the example of the plastic crates, they were quite volatile at first. It only became bankable when it covered more products, more customers, more regions. You start with a huge concentration risk with a single customer, single product, single region, yep. And you know the harvest is good or it's not good, and your faith depends on it. And at that stage, these are investments by strategic corporates who have a long-term interest, or it's venture capital, and the bank comes in later. But also as a bank, we are thinking about these business models, and we are having some very interesting discussions with corporate clients on this lately, because it's not just startups taking initiatives here. Actually, a lot of these kind of initiatives, sort of setting up logistics, circular packaging, etc., it comes from large companies and vendor leasing as well. I mean, you, Patrick, know that better than anyone, I think, that corporates are thinking about this and looking for ways how to set it up.
Yeah, when you mentioned the starting point, which is about one product in one region with one customer, and it's could be based on a big company running that with having, let's say, a decent cash flow and some equity cushion and so on. But it could also be a startup. And what I see, I mean, there's some valleys of death out there, and I see a valley of death also in that case, yeah, that you start with a few dozens, a few hundreds of assets. You might be able to finance that yourself, maybe with some support from friends and family, some first business angels. And to keep growing, you need to fund these assets. And on the other end of the side of the valley, there's a bank, yeah, that naturally also requires to have more validation, yeah, that you don't have yet, yeah. And I know at least half a dozen of startups from Europe that didn't manage to reach these, let's say, 1,000, 5,000 subscriptions to be eligible and reliable enough to start serious talks with the banks. Coming to the question, you're sitting, let's say, on the other end of the valley. Yeah, do you see any patterns of those providers that reach your territory and managed to validate that proposition in comparison to those who didn't make it? Maybe there is no answer, because I don't necessarily see a pattern. I have some clues about it, but yeah, how is it from your perspective?
That's a very good question. So this is exactly what I'm saying. This is the key challenge also for us as a bank. You know, it's a big piece of the puzzle is how do I finance these new asset pools that I need to build up, which are capital intensive? And the answer is I can do some of it as a bank, and we are thinking about, you know, what can we do to support more of it? This is our responsibility that we want to take. But then again, the role of a bank is still also to protect the money of our customers. So we can only do so much of it. And to answer your question, if I look at the example with the plastic crates, you know, they had a long-term strategic investor and who believed in this business model and financed it through some dips and cycles, which is exactly what you know, a strategic investor is for. So this was a large company doing a different business, but adjacent business, who believes in this business model and put in money several times again. It paid off for them, right? It paid off, you know, 20 times or more in what they invested. It's been very successful. But before they became bankable, that was really, you need to invest and reach a certain size and stability to get to that point.
Yeah,
that's the truth. And I think if you look at startups who made it, they typically have a strong anchor investor at the start, and then they have several rounds of money where, you know, they grow and need further money. And then the question becomes, at what point can I start supporting this as a bank? Because obviously the initial high risk money is also expensive money for a corporate share capital, and I need to show a high return on that. And if I build up a bigger asset base, I cannot pay, you know, 20%+ on every plastic crate that I'm making. So I need to get access to more affordable capital.
Yeah.
And you know, it starts with venture debt, and then you get to bank financing, etc. And it's probably combinations of different financial instruments. But you need somebody who has a long breath to actually support you before, you know, this becomes a self-running system.
Yeah, I definitely would agree. It's really hard for an independent startup without a strategic investor to starting it is not that difficult, but reaching the next level of growth without a strategic investor is hard, especially since most investment funds don't necessarily want to invest in the assets. Yeah, they want to invest in the growth. One exception to me is Grover. They managed to design a special purpose vehicle, which is a bit like an asset-backed fund. So they somehow managed to make their products investable, so to say, and opened a new asset class. But that seems to be the exception.
Yeah, and what you have to remember is that the corporate also, as corporates are having challenges as well that they need to solve for. So they do need to think about, under European regulation, they need to think about how they make more circular use of resources, how they make more efficient use of energy. So I think there's a lot of potential in the next few years for what we call corporate venturing, how startups, you know, cooperate on a longer term basis with corporates, how you connect both. And this is part of what I'm very interested on right now, because it's a win-win situation for the corporate and the startup. That's part of what the ecosystem that we are part of should be doing for our customers. Because there's something in it for both sides. And actually, startups tend to be a lot more efficient use of money than, for instance, internal R&D. So there's some good reasons for corporate to start this cooperation, but it's a fairly new subject, and we need to get more people interested in it.
Yeah, definitely. I want to come back to the question I mentioned before. So now we talked a bit about asset pools, and I want to come back to the cash flow design. Are there any successful patterns you see when it comes to product as a service cash flow design with the asset pool in mind?
Well, there's one major thing to consider also from a financing perspective, which is that products as a service, thinking from the situation of an existing provider of products or services, products as a service will dramatically change the structure of your cash flows. So one industry where products as a service is very successful is software as a service. And I do not know if this is because people have less trouble renting instead of owning something that they can drop on their feet or cannot drop on their feet and that they don't see anyway. Maybe it's just because software is a less emotional asset category. But when I was doing leverage buyouts for ERP, payroll software, and other software providers in the late 2010s, these were starting to move to cloud-based and software subscription models. The B2B customers were often quite open to this. But what happens is the long-term effect is positive for the producer seller because he gets higher and more stable revenues with improved profitability because you also include some service component. But we had quite some covenant and liquidity issues in certain cases, because initially my sales and my profit and my cash flow, they go down. So if I have an average 5-year product life and I used to sell my software package up front, then now if I start a subscription, I have a 5-year transition period where initially in year one, I only get 20% of the revenue and my revenue goes down 80% in year one. Theoretically, I switch all my contracts at once.
Yeah.
And it takes 5 years to be back at the same revenue and cash flow where I started. And in the meantime, I'm building up this big pool of contracts with a future value. And depending on your shareholder and management situation, and also how your accounting strategy is on this, but it needs to be very well explained and managed. It's really going through a massive transformation with your company. And it conflicts with your short-term targets, you know, for a certain quarterly revenue and profit. So at the end of the day, it's a question just of the revenue recognition shifting in time and the cash shifting in time. But it becomes quite difficult to explain to your investors if you're publishing quarterly earnings as a listed company. It's just, it's too detailed. So you have to think about how you temporize the change. And it's also more difficult if your lender or investor lacks sector know-how. If you're financed by a local bank in Germany, they may not have a full understanding of products as a service and software as a services. And then always what happens is the short-term cash flow goes down as you're ramping up the asset base of closed contracts with underlying service agreements. And I actually need a financing strategy and clarify with my banks when switching this and how do I finance this pool of contracts that I'm building up. So it brings us straight back to the financing question that I mentioned before. It's always, yes, sustainability and strategy and a good product and business model, but I also always have to think about the financing, and these factors are inseparable.
And do you see then also classical leasing instruments as bridge solution, but sometimes maybe also ultimate solutions from the perspective of the provider, so that actually the bank covers this cash flow risks and based on some criteria immediately pays the provider manufacturer the product value, which makes it a bit easier and maybe also a bit more affordable for the provider. It's closer to the core business, to traditional sales business, but you can still offer such a model to your customers.
Yeah, so leasing is certainly one of the solutions you may use. And then there's reverse factory. If you have large customers, then you could use reverse factory. And then there's borrowing base and inventory finance that I might be able to use in some cases. And then there's securitization solutions. So it very much depends on your product and on your size. Like for the forklift manufacturer, you start setting up separate leasing companies, which are part of your group, but have their own financing and can actually emit bonds or securitized loans to finance the fleet of assets that you're creating. That's like the biggest case. And on a very small basis, I might just be cooperating with a bank to make certain leasing constructions for the products that I sell. If I think about a manufacturing site that uses hydrogen and CO2 to make alcohol, that would be something that you could do a leasing construction on, because it's a 20, 30 million facility or a heat pump, maybe. Those are things that you could think about, efficient leasing solutions in a quite standardized way.
Okay.
So it depends. There's different solutions to get liquidity flowing in the system once you've reached a certain size.
One tiny question. I never heard of reverse factoring. Can you shortly explain that?
Oh, so this is where my customer is a big, well-known company. Like maybe I'm providing services to Commerzbank and I have a large number of invoices on them. And then somebody else may say, well, Commerzbank is a good risk. You're only a small company, but I'm happy to buy your invoices to Commerzbank from you because I know that they pay slowly, but they will pay you after 2 months or whatever the term is. And in the meantime, so I buy them from you at a slight discount, and then I get the money once, Commerzbank pays. So this is quite frequently used. It's a good system.
This is factoring, right?
That's factoring, and then the reverse factoring would be to also pay up from my suppliers, and then I only need to pay the factoring for firm once I got paid by my customer.
Okay, gotcha. And let's say last question on the asset pool and cash flow perspective is about interest rates. When we started Blue Movement now about 6 years ago, interest rates were at about, let's say, 1%. And we know over the last years, interest rates grew, which make it a bit more difficult to reach profitability, especially when it comes to long-term contracts. Keep in mind, home appliances last many years. That might be different for, let's say, shoes. If you want to rent those shoes, like On does it with running shoes, that it might be just 6 to 12 months. But we also talked about forklifts and other B2B services that may easily go beyond 10 years. Rising interest rates are a risk. Is it in any way different for product as a service? Did you observe something here? Or is it just like, yeah, it's a risk and you have to account for that?
So I think so the one point is that if I offer this at a certain price, I need to make sure I lock in the interest rate. So I need to hedge or have a long-term financing. I always need to match sort of the life of my assets yeah. with the life of my financing and fix the interest. That's just good housekeeping. That's something you need to think about. In general, you know, why do interest rates go up? It's because the central bank is saying we need to invest a little bit less because we're causing too much inflation. So this is actually what it's supposed to do, is make it a little bit more difficult to invest. And some of the investments are no longer profitable. I think if you're truly in a growing business model, it becomes less of an issue, because if you're expanding properly and are successful at this, then your margins and your growth makes up for the interest that you pay. I think it gets tougher on these kind of fleet financing questions because it simply becomes more expensive to set them up, to create the pool of assets, and it pushes up the price of these business models. So yes, not every idea, not every business model will work as well in a high interest environment as in a low interest environment. It's part of the world we live in.
Okay.
But yeah, I think generally if you have, the most successful ideas like the plastic rates, there's a lot more value add to that. It adds value also on protecting the stuff which is in the crate. It offers the bananas better protection than the cardboard boxes do.
True.
So if you have this kind of value add for your customer and for your value chain, then the level of interest, or if I pay a euro or 1 euro 10 for one use of this product, it becomes less relevant.
Yeah, good one. And I think also what I mentioned before, it really depends on the, let's say, product lifetime and the cycles, the length of your contracts. Yeah, the longer the contracts, the higher the impact of change in interest rates. Leonard, let's zoom out a bit and let's look at product as a service in general. I have three generic questions for everyone who's part of that series. And the first one is, what's the main thing you need to make sure as a brand or manufacturer before you want to start a circular product as a service?
I think the financing perspective is that what we've been discussing. It's think about the cash flow, who's paying who, when, who's building up a pool of assets. Remember that products as a service will dramatically change the structure of your cash flows as compared to selling products previously. Those, if you think about that, that I think is half of the work from a financing perspective.
Let's look into the future. What are the significant trends you see for circular renting in the next 5 years?
So as a bank, I think we're a bit more remote on this because we come in at a later stage once the business models are more established. So I follow the trend. I don't create the trend. But I think in general, I think software as a service is opening the door for products as a service in a B2B environment. And I think the B2B environment is more open than consumers, keyword capital efficiency and focus on core business. So we saw this in company premises. A few companies nowadays own their offices, And, you know, we're seeing it now with renting work clothing for cooks and safety clothes and hospital personnel. And this is already getting quite normal. And it makes a lot of sense. So I think we're still a bit further off with consumers on this. But what I see overall is that circularity is getting importance as a topic. And my corporate customers are rethinking how they can close the loop. And, you know, recycling is one part of it, but products as a service is also a very important solution for this. It's all about preventing downcycling and using the same product for longer. So, for instance, offering modular upgrades for products, refurbishing it, or at least use the raw materials for longer and recycling it. So it's a huge opportunity here. For instance, the availability of certain bio-based raw materials is going to change fundamentally over the next few years. If you think about cotton, there's only so much cotton that we produce worldwide, and it's not so easy to expand the production of cotton. But if I start recycling this or reusing it in a different way, I can have a much larger share of clothes made from this fiber because I'm using it four times. So there's four times as much bio-based fiber available in the market. So I think we will see major changes and new business models in the next 5 and 10 years. And I think we, as a bank, we will be seeking to support some of this where we can.
Nice. At the beginning, you mentioned the ecosystem you're also part of and you're building and supporting. And here again, circularity is about sharing knowledge and connecting people. You probably have certain topics you work on right now. Who should reach out to you these days? Whom do you want to talk to?
So we are cooperating with many players, and I love exchanging thoughts with investors, startups, other banks, and corporates especially. But in practice, it's too much for just me or just a few colleagues in the ESG and sustainable finance team. So this gets channeled a little bit through platforms and organizations, Neosphere for startups, then we are cooperating with TechRatier for impact investors. We are cooperating with the Bundesinitiative for impact investing for corporates. We have, you know, the relationship manager at Commerzbank, and we are cooperating in the Zuka sustainability circle. So we are getting joined up on specific topics like recycling and products and services, or at specific events like the Impact Festival. And what happens is the more complex and challenging the questions become, you know, a lot of it gets done by relationship managers and financial engineering specialists or financing specialists. And they involve the ESG and sustainable finance team, of which I'm part in a targeted way. But that's how it works.
Yeah. Okay, cool. There's a touch point literally for everyone who's working on circular business models. It's great that you cover such a wide range of people and services. Thanks a lot, Leonard, for providing some insights into financing circular business models, in particular product as a services.
Yeah, thank you, Patrick.
This was another episode of PaaS Decoded, 16 conversations about the fine details of product as a service. If you liked it, share this episode with colleagues or on social media. If you missed a question or topic, please send me an email so I can improve the conversations for you. If you learned something from this episode, please provide a review via Spotify or Apple Podcasts. That helps others to discover the podcast. And don't forget, the most abundant renewable resource is your imagination.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.